recused from this matter. Mr. Sullivan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor.
This is a petition for further review, so you may proceed.
Robert M. Sullivan for the appellee, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes. May it please the court, we have asked for review of this appeal because the appellate court has found no authority to exclude this type of case from revised statute 25217. Important to note that we are not asking that all dissolution actions be excluded from 25217, only modification actions. The 2015 case Moore v. Moore, 22 NIP App 772, the appellate court said that they saw no authority to accept dissolution actions, requirement of 25217. Points on that, the authority does exist, and the issue at bar is a modification, not a dissolution. The authority is Wooden v. County of Douglas, 275 Nebraska 971, a 2008 case, in which the court found that 25217 does not apply to the appeal of an eminent domain case from county court to district court. This is because an appeal in an eminent domain case is not a new case, it is a continuation of the action already filed. Basically, after a summons has been filed in the case, there's no need to reissue a second summons. Facts and circumstances of this case.
Isn't an eminent domain case different in that the county court isn't acting as a court in an eminent domain case, but really just as an administrative ministerial body?
There are some procedural differences, and the court does address those in a different way. But I think the analogy is attributable to this case simply because there already has been the filing of the case, and then later pleadings in that case in our trigger a need for a new summons.
So your rule would apply to all modifications?
Not necessarily. Modifications may be with certain things already going on in that case, such as this case where there is already extensive litigation taking place, pending appeals, parties represented by counsel. There's a lot of facts and circumstances in this case that add to that distinction in the law.
So you would concede, for example, that a dissolution followed 10 years later by a modification, there would be no textual reason to exclude that from the reach of the statute.
I can see that being a reasonable distinction.
Well, what is the textual basis based on 217 to exclude the modification action?
Well, 217 is basically a statute in order to keep cases from sitting on the docket without any action going on in them, to keep surprise from happening after years of something sitting dormant, then all of a sudden the pleading being filed and an order maybe being entered on a case where somebody had not even realized the case was still on the docket. In this case, we're well beyond that because of all the activity in this case at the time, both parties being represented by counsel. As a matter of fact, when Mrs. Burns was given a copy of this modification, she immediately contacted her attorney. There was already communication between the two attorneys in the case regarding this modification within a short time of it being filed. And then later there was all the pleadings about within 6 weeks of the filing, all the pleadings were given to Mrs. Burns. And since that time, she had vigorously defended herself in this case until today.
Is there anything that you can point to in the record that would constitute a voluntary appearance?
I believe there is. In Judge Doyle's order, he talks about motions being filed after the case was sent back down to the court, and he ended up ruling on those. He didn't rule on those motions. He simply said those are the hearings on those are taken off the docket. I'm going to enter the order in this case. The special appearance had already been filed in the case. So we know that that order that Judge Doyle then canceled the hearings on was not regarding the jurisdiction of the court. It was not regarding the lack of a summons. It was at least something else than that. So I believe that constitutes a voluntary appearance in this case because that motion is a request for relief in the case. And if you look at...
And where does... What motion... What specifically did the motion request?
The motion was for a recusal of, basically a recusal of counsel trying to have me withdraw from the case and to sanction me and my client for things that were going on in the case.
And where does that appear in our record?
That motion was not sent up in the transcript. We did ask the court to allow us to offer that motion for purpose of this hearing, but that was denied. So the only evidence of that is in Judge Doyle's order.
Thank you.
The facts and circumstances of this case...
Counsel, I apologize, but what's the effect of that the mandate hadn't been spread on the record at the time that the district court took up the application to modify? How did the court have jurisdiction?
I think the court has continuing jurisdiction on this case because any family law case has continuing jurisdiction under 42, I think 365. It's been recognized in these family law cases to have continuing jurisdiction. So, and this case, of course, is a many-headed beast. There's appeals pending while other motions are being heard by the district court because we have the custody of a child at issue. We have a lot of issues going on in the case, and so we've had to relook at whether the court has jurisdiction on various issues throughout this case. So there's been a lot of pleadings filed, a lot of hearings on those types of things. So I think the fact that the mandate hadn't been spread on the previous appeal, on the child support appeal, does not take jurisdiction away from the court on the other issues.
Okay, what, did you cite any legal authority for that?
Not off the top of my head, to be honest with you, Your Honor.
And you say the court had continuing jurisdiction. Isn't that continuing jurisdiction limited to enforce the existing orders?
It's to enforce the existing order, but also take up issues with regard to the best interest of the child if those types of things are presented to the court. And in this case, that had been presented to the court, the child's failure to do well in school, to get to class, to pass courses, disciplinary actions. And so I think Judge Doyle looked at that and said, this is something where we have a child here who is in danger and we need to take action on it, even though there is a pending appeal in the case. 42-365 gives us that ability.
Was Carrie's motion to disqualify filed after the modification was filed?
Yes, I believe it was filed in September. Modification was filed in June. Her motion was filed, I believe, in September. Judge Doyle's order, which canceled the hearing on that motion, was on October 31st. So we know that it was filed after the modification was filed, but before the spreading of the mandate.
Would that qualify as a general appearance?
I believe it does. I believe it's a voluntary appearance, general appearance type pleading, because it doesn't take much to do that. Even a motion for continuance is enough to, accept the jurisdiction of the court.
And then defects in service, if any, would be waived at that point?
It would, yes.
Thank you.
So your argument, I think, would be it's a two-step. We know the motion exists because of the judge's order, and the judge's order has absolute verity under our case law. That's a term of art. Is that what your argument is? And the motion that the judge's order recites would have been the voluntary appearance?
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor. So we have a special appearance, which, the court has taken the stance that special appearance is not a general appearance or a voluntary appearance, even though it was an abolished pleading. And I think that even you could look at that and say, it was an abolished pleading. It's a pleading in the case that we think is also a voluntary appearance. So with that, I reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you. Mr. Cabot, good morning.
Morning. May it please the court. My name is Matt Catlett. I represent the appellant, Carrie Burns, in this case. I guess the non-petition party put on the screen here a summons looks like. This is a document that you request from the court issue when you file a complaint. And the law says that this has to be served along with your complaint unless you have requested service by publication. This is a statute that the legislature has enacted, and many years before I went to law school, I learned that the legislature writes the law, they make the law, and the courts tell us what the law is, what the legislature has. The executive branch carries out the laws, and we know 25217, we've been talking about it here. This statute essentially came out of Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 4M. 4M, it says it's a similar rule, however, it is a court rule. And Federal Rule of Civil Procedure Rule 1 says essentially that a court can waive it or excuse noncompliance in the interest of justice. Now, that rule said 120 days, but it also said that the plaintiff could, you know, if good cause was shown, the court could excuse that 120 days extended. Well, as I understand it, it shows 180 days here, our legislature, and the reason, and just we're going to choose something far off, we're going to say that there's nothing, there's no excuse, there's no extending that deadline. And so it is a hard and fast rule. You've got to serve your complaint, you've got to serve process within 6 months or the case is dismissed by operation of law, no docket entry is needed, no motion is needed, no nothing, it's just gone.
Unless, of course, there was a voluntary appearance.
Unless there was a voluntary appearance. And there was no voluntary appearance in this matter. There's been some questioning of the petitioning party's counsel today about some motion that was filed, I guess, between the filing of the application to modify and the filing of the special appearance. I'll note that the non-appealing party can file a precipice for a supplemental transcript at any time prior to case submission. That's what the court rules say. And at no time was this transcript supplemented by the appellee. The first time that the appellee sought to supplement the transcript was simultaneous with the filing of the petition for further review. This court, of course, denied that request properly in view of the appellant.
Is where you're going that the motion to disqualify is not in the record?
It's not in our record. And at some point, you know, the court has to say, this is the record. And we get lots of time, you know. And I believe the rule says until the matter is submitted. And then even after the matter is submitted, I says, I think you have to get leave of court, if I understand the rules of appellate practice, that even after that, you could still get it. And at no time during the pendency of this appeal was that done. It was done filing a petition for further review.
Well, what's your overall purpose here, counsel? You want to stall this proceeding and start over again?
Sorry?
You want to stall this proceeding and start over again? Is that the purpose of this? This claim there's no jurisdiction? I mean, what will happen? Will they just go back and start over again?
Yeah.
With the modification?
Yeah, there was no case. Yeah. So
what good does that do anybody?
Well, that's the rule. That's the statute that the legislature enacted, and they found, you know, the people.
Well, you can
state of Nebraska,
you can waive the service of summons. You could have waived it and come in and litigated the issues, couldn't you?
Yeah, the statute says that a voluntary appearance constitutes a waiver of service, but a special appearance is specifically designed to object to the court's exercise of personal jurisdiction over.
Was there a situation where the party, the husband, asked for an alternate method of service?
No.
Didn't petition the court for that?
No. No. The only thing that happened in this case was that the appellee moved the court to appoint a special process server. I think that was it. But as pointed out in my brief, that doesn't excuse the necessity of a summons. That just says, well, somebody other than a sheriff's deputy could serve the process. You still need a summons. And you know, the legislature changed the law with respect to modification cases. It used to be that these could be initiated upon motion. But that law was changed. So now you got to file a complaint. And got to get a summons, and the statutes specifically say that service shall comport with a dissolution action, which requires personal service of summons.
I'd like to shift gears with you just a little bit.
This is what's wrong.
We have a rule of appellate procedure that says that an appellate court may take judicial notice of interwoven proceedings. You're familiar with that rule, no doubt. It thus would be proper, would it not, for us to consider the transcript and the bill of exceptions that was filed in respect to case 13-1053?
Well, and so, I mean, yes. So, as the court knows, there was no.
Oh, all right.
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
And the reason is because, see, the problem is with modification cases, they get assigned to the same case number in the district court. They get filed under the same case number. And so what that causes is this confusion as to who, you know, the original, there was an appeal pending, as the court knows, in this other matter, and the mandate had not yet been spread by the trial court as of the date that the application to modify was filed. Well, on remand, you know, the Court of Appeals says trial court needs to prepare and attach the child support, applicable child support calculation worksheet. So when we went back on remand, there were things that were happening in that case, okay? And although I don't feel like I need to argue that, I can sense that the court wants me to answer that question about whether this purported motion to disqualify somehow was a general appearance by the appellant in, like, the other case. And that's not the case. The
I'm sorry, would you say that again? I'm not sure. You may be putting words in my mouth that I hadn't thought of, but
well,
I want to think about
it. As I understand it, the argument goes that Carrie entered a voluntary appearance when she filed this motion to disqualify, this alleged motion to disqualify, because it's not in the transcript in this appeal. But there's a vague reference to it in the court's, one of the court's orders. And so can we take judicial notice of this? Well, reality is that cases, modification cases, you know, once a decree of dissolution is entered, there's a case number on the district court. CI something, you know, a year and then a digits, you know. And future cases, there's no law or rule or statute that says this, but they just get filed under that case number.
Isn't there a good reason for that?
Well, that
isn't the judgment. The original judgment is the decree of dissolution, and everything else after that is a summary application after judgment, correct?
Well, I mean, a modification, you still have to file a complaint and follow...
But that doesn't change the nature of what it is, does it?
No, I can see that. I'm just saying that if this was a... If you had to file it under a... If the clerk assigned a new case number, you know, we wouldn't be talking about it. It would be clear that these were different proceedings in which the motion to disqualify...
Well, I think I'd like to return to my previous question, which was, why isn't it proper for us to take notice, if it makes any difference at all? I'm not saying it does, but why shouldn't we take notice of the Bill of Exceptions and the transcript in 13-1053 and perhaps even in 13... whatever the first one was before the original remand.
Because you can always file a precedent. I mean, the appellee can always supplement the record and can seek to supplement the record with, I guess, whatever the appellee wants to, and in this case, that wasn't done.
Well, always is... That ship sort of sailed, didn't it?
Well, yeah.
I mean, that's what you've already argued.
Yeah. So, no, I guess, I mean, I think that the court can take notice that... opinion was issued, or that a mandate was issued, or that there was a motion filed in the other case. Now, I got 10 seconds left here. You know, one of the issues that I'm not going to have enough time to talk about is, well, does a motion to disqualify constitute a general appearance? You know, and that is certainly, you know, nothing that's been briefed yet, nothing that, you know, and I might have something to say about that if that was sort of an issue on the table. With that, my time is done, I thank you.
We would take it that you would argue that it is not a general address.
You could safely assume that that would be my argument, if that was up before the court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
We have a minute and 28 seconds.
A minute and 28 seconds, Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you. The appellant in this case has shown no prejudice. I did misquote the citation for the continuing jurisdiction. That's 42-351. I would ask the court to take judicial notice of all the appeals that have been filed in this case in the last 3 years, including 13-1053. The issue as to whether or not the voluntary appearance constitutes, or the motion constitutes voluntary appearance, is addressed in Friedman v. Friedman, 290 Nebraska 973, and also Nebraska Revised Statute 25516.01 paragraph 2, and does not take much at all to constitute a voluntary appearance. 2 points that I wasn't able to make early on, and which I think are raised again, is whether or not the complaint to modify is actually a complaint under purposes of the statutes that we're talking about in this case. A complaint to modify does not start a new civil action. It does not open a new case. Like we've already noted, the case number has remained the same in this since the year 2003.
But your opposing counsel is not keen on that custom.
That's right, but I sure am. So I would ask the court to acknowledge that both similar to the eminent domain case, in that case an appeal is not like the appeal we have here today. And so the court found a distinction, I think, based on somewhat on that. I think we can also look at this case today and say a complaint to modify is not the complaint that starts a case.
Isn't it equally likely or possible that a complaint for modification could be filed and simply sit there and nothing happen for it, just in the same way that an original complaint could be filed and sit there with no process having been served? Why wouldn't the purpose of 25217 be exactly the same in the context of a modification?
I think that one thing is that was not the case here. Certainly it was feverishly contested from day one. But I think that you can even draw a distinction on that and say, well, let's look at the facts and circumstances of the case and see if a case really has been sitting there or not, and look at it based on the merits of that one issue.
But what does that do to what seems to me to be a prophylactic rule?
Well, you can look back on that and say, well, now that a motion has been filed, it has been more than 6 months, you have let this go. I mean, you have, there's been nothing going on in this case, and it is dismissed. But in this case, you would look at that and say, gosh, from day one, there has been activity and a very high level of activity.
But we've already said half a dozen times that this is self-executing.
It is, but then you look back at the eminent domain case, and then you look at the vagueness of the statutes here when they talk about something like a complaint and say, is a complaint always a complaint? You know, and the statute doesn't seem to contemplate that. The statute just doesn't look at the variables involved in family law cases that have continuing jurisdiction in them.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next case of the day is State versus Erica A. Jenkins. Justice Connolly will rejoin the court for this case.